Hey, welcome back to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We are glad you are here for Wednesday, the 25th day of March. You may be aware that Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero has proposed $75,000 in his proposed fiscal year budget that begins July 1st, 75 grand for body cameras for police, 100 of them altogether. And Mike Yankowski, LPD chief, told the State Journal yesterday that 100 cameras will certainly get our entire road patrol staffed with body cameras when they go out and work the roads. That'll give us a good working sample. He says that the goal is to equip every Lansing police officer at some point in time. The police department in February, I'm reading from Christopher Bennon's article in today's journal, the police department in February applied for more than a $400,000 federal grant for 210 body cameras and a research program through Michigan State University. According to Yankowski, the MSU program would study the benefit of the cameras to both police and the community. So it would appear that this is going to be approved. So far, I think a pretty positive reception to this. So we should probably plan for the idea of body cameras on LPD patrol officers, road patrol officers, in the not-too-distant future. I'm Mark Bayshore. On Current State, to begin our program here today, public education in Michigan will have a new leader this summer. Last week, the State Board of Education voted 7-1 to hire Dearborn Schools Chief Brian Whiston as the next state superintendent. He'll replace Michael Flanagan, who will retire in July after 10 years at the helm of the Michigan Department of Education. Mr. Whiston's appointment is pending formal approval from the State Board, which is expected soon. He will inherit a public education system that's wrestling with issues ranging from charter school authorization to standardized testing. Joining me now by phone to talk about his new appointment and his vision for the future, Michigan's incoming state superintendent, Brian Whiston. Welcome to Current State, sir.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me on.
A doctor has to look at the X-ray before they begin an operation. What does that X-ray of public education in Michigan look like to you? What are the problem areas that need adjusting?
Well, I think there's a lot to celebrate. There's a lot of great teachers who are making a difference in the lives of kids every day, and we need to celebrate that. But with that said, we can do better, and we have to change what's happening in a lot of our classrooms to get students to take ownership of their learning and to have teachers be more facilitators of the learners. Those who are doing the talking are doing the learning. So we want students to be doing the investigation, the talking, using technology to investigate, and really understand where they're at in reading and math and graph and chart their growth. So classroom instruction will be the focus.
Are students not taking enough ownership of their education these days?
Well, I think for a long time we as adults just kind of delivered the instruction and expected students to soak it up. And with some students that works, but every student has a different learning style. And I think, we have to find those learning styles and what excites kids about learning and use that information to help them. So, for example, you say you don't like math, but you love baseball. Baseball is all about math. So how can we use, baseball to teach you math? It's really about finding what excites and motivates students to learn and then using that information to help them.
Michigan will phase in a new standardized test this year called MSTEP, the Michigan Student Test of Educational Progress. But we're already seeing some backlash to that measure. A Detroit Free Press article this week indicates that a growing number of parents are choosing to opt out of having their kids take the MSTEP. How are you addressing that in Dearborn?
Well, I think, first of all, it's important that our students take a variety of different types of tests. Teachers need to drive instruction and understand if kids are learning what they're supposed to, so there's different types of assessments that they use. And it's certainly fair for the taxpayers to hold us accountable to how our students achieve, so we need tests to show that. So we do need a variety of different types of tests. I just wonder if we could find a way to mix those tests and maybe test a little less. I mean, for the state test is for high schools, it's about 15 hours. For elementary and middle school students, it's 7 to 9 hours. And I just wonder, in this day and age of technology, if there isn't a test out there that can see what students know and how they could transfer that knowledge and do it in a way that we can reduce the amount of testing. So that's certainly something I want to look into.
Would you characterize the larger public response to assessments as a backlash? Do you feel like we're going through a period of backlash against testing and assessments?
Well, I think parents are raising concerns about the amount of testing, and I think teachers are raising the concerns that, you know, we're doing so much testing that we're losing instructional time. And so that's why I think we have to find a marriage between what teachers need to know to drive instruction and what, from an accountability model, is fair to hold schools accountable. So I do think we need to work with the testing experts to find a way to reduce the amount of testing on students so more time can be spent in the classroom investigating and learning.
We're talking today with Dearborn Public School Superintendent Brian Whiston. He is Michigan's incoming state schools superintendent. He's expected to take over those duties in July on the retirement of Michael Flanagan. There's a fight brewing now between Governor Snyder and the State Board of Education. The governor signed an executive order last week that transfers the School Reform Office out of the hands of the board and into the Department of Technology Management and Budget, and that office directly reports to Governor Snyder. There's some question as to whether the governor has the legal authority to make that move. What's your position?
Well, first of all, we're going to provide services to the students in those districts because it's got to be about them first and helping them be successful and helping the staff with professional development and what they need to turn around those districts. So, first of all, we're going to focus on providing support to the staff and students to help them achieve. That's going to be our number one goal. And number two, I hope in time that the governor will see that we are about holding ourselves and our teachers, our administrators, our superintendents accountable for at least a year's growth out of students and sometimes more, and that building that relationship that the governor eventually will move the program back within the department where I think it belongs. But first of all, let's concentrate on meeting the needs of kids, and then we'll worry about what department it's in.
How much will the outcome of this dispute impact your job?
Well, I hope that once the governor and I and the state board get a chance to have a conversation that it won't be a dispute, that we'll be focused on providing what the kids need to be successful and what the staff needs, and we'll move forward from this. So I'm hoping it won't be a dispute at all.
The governor has no direct control over the State Board of Education. However, you've spent some of your career as a lobbyist for the Oakland schools. You've been in both the educational and the political realms, if you will. Do you see the state superintendent as a bridge between the Department of Education and the governor's office?
Yeah, I hope so, and with legislators. I hope that I can use the relationships that I've built over the last 20, 25 years to really focus us on, as I said, students first. And if we could do that, we could argue behind the scenes about what's right and what's best and come to an agreement on how to move forward. But let's focus on the success of the students first and foremost.
Incoming Michigan State School Superintendent Brian Whiston is our guest this morning on WKAR's Current State. How do you feel about getting this gig? I mean, this is a big, big job with a ton of moving parts. How do you feel about
taking over? I'm very excited about the opportunity. You know, I think the state board is outstanding. They're good people who care about kids and want to move education forward, not only to help struggling school districts, but help districts that are achieving and have the department, you know, continue to be a model department and continue to grow. And so it's an exciting opportunity. I'm a little bit sad because there's a lot of great things that our board in Dearborn and our administration and teachers working together are achieving, and I kind of want to be here to see those through. But, you know, I'll have to look at it from afar and continue to support Dearborn and other school districts and help them be successful.
I want to ask you about the Office of School Reform again here and the EAA. Those two bodies work pretty closely with each other. The EAA, of course, operates 15 of the most underperforming schools in the city of Detroit. It's come in for criticism, some of it intense indeed. The state board's been skeptical. What's your view of the EAA? Is it a necessary layer of oversight? Does it need a lot of reform in your view? What?
Well, I think, first of all, I'm excited about the committee in Detroit that is looking at how They would like to see education shaped in the city of Detroit, and I'm very encouraged that that committee will come up with some recommendations for the department and the governor and legislature to look at. That's number one. Number two, I'm about success and giving opportunities for whether it be the EAA or school districts to turn around. But if they don't, then we have to take action because the students deserve better and the staff deserves better. And so where there isn't success, we will hold people accountable and we will take action. I will always be focused on what's best for kids, and that means if something's not working, it has to be changed.
What do you think chronically underperforming districts need the most?
Well, we need to change what's happening in the classroom. You know, we had some schools here in Dearborn that were performing, you know, in the low teens in terms of the state rating system. And, you know, what we did is changed administrators. We worked with the teachers that were in the buildings. We worked with the parents. We had a very focused school improvement plan. And we really changed what was taking place in the classroom, providing professional development to the staff, but really intense intervention for students. Now that school's performing in the 70-75 percentile, so it can happen. That was a school that had 99% economic disadvantaged, 70-80% English language learners, and we were able to turn it around in a couple of years. So when we focus on the things we should, which is the classroom instruction, we can improve a school or a school district.
I need to ask you about the third grade reading discussion here. This week, a House Appropriations Subcommittee eliminated funding for adult education in the 2015-16 school year, but it also eliminated money for Governor Snyder's third grade reading initiative. Where are you on this third grade reading discussion, at least broadly?
Well, what we did in Dearborn is starting in third grade, going all the way up through ninth grade, any student who's a year or more behind in reading and or math, we sign a parent contract where it talks about what we're going to do as a school district to get the student up to reading or math level and what we need the parents to do. And if the parents don't live up to their end of the bargain, then there is some discussion about holding the student back. Now, I don't believe in holding students back. I don't think that's the right thing to do or successful, but we have to work together with parents to get this growth in reading and math. We have the kids about 12% of the calendar year, and parents have them 88% of the calendar year. So it has to be a partnership. So do I believe in holding school districts and parents accountable for students being on grade level, third through ninth, in reading and math? Yes, I do.
How common is this contract approach?
As far as I know, we're the only district doing it. We're sharing it with other districts and hope people understand because it is working. I mean, you see these third or fourth graders who are behind, and every month they're charting their growth. They're getting excited about it. They're focused on their personal goals. And when you're focused on a personal goal, you get growth. And it's making a difference here in Dearborn every day.
What do you think about the funding move here? The governor wanted to spend $25 million for his third grade program. Is cutting that short-sighted, like some people say?
Well, I mean, we need funding to help with at-risk students. So whether we do it through the third grade reading, whether we do it by putting more money in at-risk funding and making sure that every district who qualifies receives the funds, I think that ought to be the focus, whether it's in the separate categorical or in the at-risk categorical. Either way, I think is fine.
We've got less than a minute. We got 30 seconds to tell you the truth, but I've got to ask you one question about charter schools. If you can answer it efficiently, so much the better. How much reform does the charter school landscape in Michigan need, in your view, if any?
Well, any school that receives tax dollars should be held accountable for student achievement, graduation rates, and how they spend their dollars. Any school that receives tax dollars.
And that is not happening sufficiently, in your view?
In some school districts, no. And so we need to work on that.
We really appreciate the chance to get to know you here today. We want to thank our guest, Dearborn Public School Superintendent Brian Whiston. In July, he is expected to take over as Michigan's state schools superintendent. We'll talk again, sir. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Thank you. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Current State at WKAR on our Facebook page. One of Lansing's top bands in recent years has been Steppin' in It, and for a long time they've played a weekly gig at the Green Door. Now fans are following the exploits of singer Joshua Davis. Current State Scott Pohl is here with more on his recent national television exposure. He's on NBC's The Voice, right?
That's right, Mark. The Voice has become a popular TV talent competition, giving American Idol a run for its money.
Yeah.
The show features music stars like Blake Shelton and Adam Levine judging and coaching the singers. Joshua Davis is one of about 20 singers left at this point in the season. Davis has moved from Lansing to Traverse City, but his local fans have remained loyal. And as you might imagine, he says he never thought he'd wind up on national television while playing all those gigs at the Green Door.
No, absolutely not. You know, I grew up in the folk realm. It's the kind of music I play is real rootsy, and usually that I don't think that's the kind of stuff that's highlighted on national television. So it's been exciting. That's for sure.
Tell me about your decision to move to Traverse City. Why did you move?
That's a good question. We've been talking about it for a long time. We'd been in Lansing for a long time. My wife and I met at Michigan State University, and I had been living there for 15 or so years. And we'd been coming up here quite a bit. I come to play. We came up to vacation. There's a lot of young families up here, and it's a pretty progressive community, and we were kind of drawn to it, and we wanted to try it out. My wife was in between jobs, and so we just kind of popped up here, and it's been good. We both miss Lansing a lot, and it's not just the Indian cuisine; it's also the people.
Are there opportunities to play in northern Michigan?
You know, I do up here. Yeah, there are. There's actually a lot of really really nice venues, and there's also I do a lot of work in schools and with different organizations, a lot of grant-funded work, a lot of kind of songwriting and recording workshops with kids, projects, anti-bullying campaign kind of stuff. So I work with several organizations up here, and that's been really, really rewarding work. And so it's been another reason why we're up here.
What's the status of Steppin' in It?
We just played a really fun, sold-out show this past weekend up here in Elk Rapids. So we're still playing, just not as often. We're all kind of doing different things, and Steppin' in It has become a band that we all love dearly, and it's something that we play the shows that we really want to play with it. It's a lot of fun when we play together. It's really meaningful, and we try to keep it that way. So it's less shows, but more better shows with that band, you know.
At this point, do you know if you have any upcoming gigs in Lansing this year?
I don't have anything in the books in Lansing right now. But I have to get back to the folks at the 10 Pound Fiddle, so hopefully I'll be back there because I love the 10 Pound Fiddle.
We're talking with Joshua Davis, the veteran frontman of the Lansing band Steppin' in It. He's been competing this season on NBC's The Voice. And Joshua, I wanted to ask you about why The Voice from out of all of the TV talent competitions. How did you wind up on The Voice?
Yeah, they called me. They had seen some videos of mine online, and they liked what they saw, and they gave me a call and asked me to come out to L.A. and audition for the show. So I had never seen the show before. So we pulled up some episodes online and watched it, and I was impressed by the kind of supportive and positive nature of the show. You know, I've got a 9-year-old daughter, and I felt comfortable with her getting into it, and that was kind of like a marker as to what kind of show it was, because we're real selective about what she watches. So I really like the way that it seems like a lot of reality television, they are, you know, trying to embarrass people or talk down to people, or it's all about the drama of it. I think this show is much more about the performances and about the musicality of the whole thing.
I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about the judges on the show and how much work you're actually doing with them, how much you're getting to know them. Tell me about the judges.
Yeah, you know, we I think as the show has gone on, we get to interact with the coaches more. And you know, so I had some time with Blake, worked with him and Megan Trainor on Knocking on Heaven's Door when we did the battle rounds with Brian Johnson, and that was a lot of fun. Not a lot of time, but it's some time. It's a couple different sessions, and then with Adam, Adam's been really great, and I've had more of a chance to hang out with him. We've done the film stuff that you know, but after this last filming, you know, he kind of like hung around for a while afterward, and we just you know talked for a while, and it was very off camera and very laid back. So it's been good, you know, and you know, I've learned from them, and I've especially learned from the other contestants. There's so much talent, and that's such a diverse group of people that that I've learned a lot from everybody on the show.
You brought up singing Knocking on Heaven's Door, and it wasn't the first time you used a Bob Dylan song on the show. I find that interesting because it's known as kind of a pop music show.
Mama, take this badge off of me. I can't use it anymore.
What kind of reactions have you gotten for using Bob Dylan songs on The Voice?
They've used Bob Dylan songs before, but I don't think ever two in a row from a contestant. The interesting thing about the show is that they don't, you know, they focus on whose version of the song you're doing, and they kind of label it as that. So, you know, in their eyes, you know, I was doing a band song because that's the band that first recorded I Shall Be Released.
I will see my light come shining from the west down to the east. Oh, any day now, I shall be released.
They have got an idea from watching my videos and from kind of finding out more about who I am. I mean, they do their research, you know, and they understand that I'm a roots, you know, roots-based artist, and so they're trying to work me into their framework in that way, and so it's been good. You know, I love those songs. It was great to have a chance to sing them. I'm up for more, you know, up for stepping out of the box a little bit, but, you know, I also am, you know, I'm just thankful to be out there, and so it's been good.
Are you starting to hear from music industry types, other musicians, producers, executives, agents, because of this exposure?
Yeah, I have been contacted by a lot of different people. There's been an incredible outpouring of interest and support. I've been kind of just putting everybody on hold until this whole ride is done. But I've been really thankful for the support from the Michigan music community, because it's been amazing. And I have been contacted by people, you know, from outside our music scene, or people that wouldn't have contacted me otherwise. There's definitely been some interest. So we'll see where that leads. I've always been somebody that, I mean, I've worked with a manager before, I've worked with a booking agency, but for a long time I've been doing it independently, and it's been very grassroots. So we'll just have to see where that goes.
Michigan-based singer Joshua Davis is competing on The Voice this season, and I wanted to ask you about whether being on The Voice has involved a crazy travel schedule for you.
Absolutely. You know, I got to spend a lot of the winter in L.A., which was not terrible. It was beautiful out there, and there's been a lot of back and forth. It's been a lot of back and forth between L.A. and Traverse City. So I fly out of the tiny little Traverse City airport, which is fun. and my family gets to come out there often, which is really nice, because that's the hardest thing about this is I've got a 9-year-old and I've got a 3-month-old now, and I've never thought that I would be away as much as I am right now, and it's been really tough. So the show has been wonderful about bringing them out there really often, and so that's helped a lot.
Are you picking up new followers on Facebook and Twitter?
Yeah, it's just been an explosion of that. I've never really been a social media guy, just because when I started out, the social media wasn't a thing, and it's become, you know, this huge promotion machine. And yeah, I mean, my, you know, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all that has just shot through the roof. You know, it's gone crazy, and so I'm learning how to use it as a tool and to connect with people on social media.
Do you think that someday, when all of this is behind you, do you have a sense yet for what this will have meant to your career to have been on The Voice?
That's a really good question. You know, I think that there's, I do have a sense for it so far, although I think there's a lot that I have yet to, there's a lot of things that are coming through right now that I can't even grab hold of. It's like, it's everything's happening so fast that it's hard to really even realize all the things that are happening because they're all happening at the same time. I'm buried under all these emails but you know, the things that I'm taking away from it right now are, number one, I'm learning a lot. I'm meeting wonderful people. You know, I was always a guy that saw his voice as a utility, and because I'm a songwriter first, guitar player second, and I thought of myself as a vocalist third. And the show has taught me to look at my voice like an instrument and to work at it like that. And it's been incredible. I've seen a huge difference in my singing from the beginning of the show until now, and that's going to stick with me for the rest of my career. And I think it's really going to help out. The other thing is just exposure. Being on national television, you know, I was playing up in the Keweenaw a couple weekends ago, and I, you know, just played this, you know, almost sold out show at this theater where before I was playing, and 100 people came. And so I was joking, like, you know, thanks for supporting my 15 years of touring and 5 minutes of national television, because there's people that have been there for the whole time. There's people that caught on because of The Voice, and I'm grateful for both sides of that. You know, I think that it's been a wonderful way to get my music to more people.
Joshua Davis, your Michigan fans are rooting for you on The Voice. Thanks for taking a few minutes to talk with us today, and good luck.
Thanks so much for having me.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And coming up on Current State, two Lansing women are raising money to help homeless women with an unmet need, feminine hygiene supplies. For our weekly Neighbors in Action series, we meet the women behind one of Lansing's newest nonprofits, Helping Women, period. And don't think of all hackers as bad. Student hackers gathering at MSU will be trying to build something this weekend, not steal stuff. Learn all about Sparta Hack coming up on Current State.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Lourdes Garcia,
Alice Ari
Shapiro,
NPR News,
Monrovia,
Sao Paulo,
Beirut,
London. Reporting from bunkers, streets, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
The morning's news between 5 and 9 on 90.5 WKAR.
WKAR is supported by Bagger Dave's Burger Tavern, featuring Bagger Dave's fresh-cut potato fries and Michigan craft beers. Different kinds of burgers, different kinds of beer, in East Lansing at the corner of Hagedorn and Grand River. And by Wharton Center, presenting Andrew Lloyd Webber's The Phantom of the Opera, April 1st through the 12th. The Phantom of the Opera features the songs The Music of the Night, All I Ask of You, and Masquerade. Ticket information at whartoncenter.com.
Well, that's the historic Barton organ at Ann Arbor's Michigan Theater. The venerable instrument is played before films every Thursday through Monday night at the downtown movie house. The Barton organ might conjure up images of the golden age of silent films accompanying the likes of Chaplin and Swanson and Valentino, but this week's Ann Arbor Film Festival, the 53rd of its kind, brings you the newest in cinema from all over the world. The Ann Arbor Film Festival takes place at the Michigan Theater and other venues through Sunday. Let's listen to this for a second. Oh, those were the days. More information on the Ann Arbor Film Festival at aafilmfest.org. Should be a good time. Wednesday on Current State means it's time for Neighbors in Action, when we feature people and organizations working to make Greater Lansing a better place. Today we talk to a new Lansing organization working to help homeless women with an often unmet need, feminine hygiene supplies. To learn more about helping women, period, we welcome Amy Stevenson and Lizney Tate, the two women behind the effort. Welcome to Current State.
Good morning.
Nice hit in the State Journal this morning, too. You guys are off to the races. You just launched in January, but you've received an awful lot of support, really pretty much out of the chute. How do you account for this?
Well, Lizney and I are fortunate enough to know a lot of people in the community from previous volunteer projects and school communities, and they've just been very receptive to our initiative, including the Lansing State Journal, area TV stations, and other online media.
$5,000 in donations after an event just yesterday morning, I understand. Pretty well-attended event in Rio Town.
Yes. That's,
well, where did this idea come from, Amy?
In January, Lizney and I had read some online articles over the course of a couple weeks, and it brought to our attention the need from various communities of homeless women, women in shelter, that a dire need that they have that a lot of people are not aware of, are feminine hygiene products. So folks think to donate coats, they think to donate soup or macaroni and cheese, but they don't think to donate these necessary items. And so after reading the article, we felt compelled that locally we could do something to reach out to these women and raise some funds and get products to the various charity partners in the area to distribute those items.
And Lizney, what have you learned since you started this organization about the struggles homeless women or low-income women face when they're on their periods?
I've learned that it really hits a chord with people. There were so many people yesterday that had tears in their eyes saying, I can't even imagine being alone or in this situation without access to any products. And I think it hits people because we've been in that situation where we've had, you know, a surprise or something, and we don't have access, and that's a little scary, but thinking about it on a regular daily basis, I mean, it's part of life. It's part of who makes you human, and it's sad that our government or whoever can't take care of that. Mm. So,
Lizney Tate is the co-founder of Helping Women, period, a new Lansing nonprofit that provides feminine hygiene supplies to local shelters and transitional housing facilities. We're joined by fellow co-founder Amy Stevenson as well. Amy, are the shelters in Lansing typically running out of these supplies on a regular basis?
Yes, they are. A lot of their clientele are obviously women, and they're women of childbearing age. And what we've learned from talking to Haven House, to Eve's House, to a lot of other different charity partners is around the holidays, they get a lot of donations of various types. But by February, March, or April, a lot of things are running low, and especially feminine hygiene products. But the demand is always there because of the demographic that they serve. So they're elated.
What kind of impact does it have on a woman's life when she doesn't have access?
Well, one issue, it's a dignity issue. And what I read in the article that I couldn't unknow after I read that is there's just no dignity in feeling that desperate for such a necessary item. Mm-hmm. So one impact from the shelter that we've learned is when a woman is on a real strict household budget, they pay for food for their children, they keep the lights on, and this is just an item that often comes last. And so the impact it would have is just a lot of stress. And lack of dignity. And I think that's what compelled us to act, is that no woman should be put in this situation.
Tell us a little bit more about your fundraising effort yesterday morning. A pretty good response.
It was an amazing response. We originally had started this whole idea with doing maybe 30 people and maybe raising $400. And
What'd you raise yesterday?
$3,000.
In the thousands. Yeah.
And it just snowballed. We posted it on Facebook on one day, and 2 days later we had to change the venue because we had too many people.
Oh, nice problem. Nice problem to have. What's the next step? How will you distribute the dollars and the product?
Our next steps are to continue to reach out to our charity partners, which we've had some time to do, but not as much as we would like, to find out what can they store, what do they have space for, and what means is it best to distribute the items. We've had a tremendous donation of bags so that we can distribute these items discreetly, especially for the homeless community, to make sure the bags are waterproof. So we'll reach out to those charity partners, find out what they need, find out how often they need it, and how they can store it. And we're going to start ordering it and turning around the product very quickly. We have an army of volunteers who've offered to drive the products as they come in to our charity partners throughout the month. So as soon as we just take a few days to catch our breath, we're going to start ordering products and getting them out to folks, which we actually already did yesterday. A lot of the charity partners that attended took hundreds of items with them to take back to their charities. So it started as of yesterday, but in full force in a couple weeks, we'll start getting things out.
I have to ask, to what extent does this resonate with men, though? I mean, are men sensitive to this, or there's an awareness raising that needs? Is there an awareness raising process involved?
Well, there were three men at our event yesterday, so I consider that a success.
Three out of
two
out
were
of,
our husbands, and one was another gentleman, but we still will take that as a success. A story that was shared with us yesterday by one of our partners through the Greater Lansing Housing Coalition is they do a parenting educational meeting as part of their transitionatory process for their clients. And one was a gentleman with three teenage daughters, and he received some of these products as part of that class. And he is a single parent, just like any single parent on a fixed budget, and he was incredibly gracious for the donation. That's a huge amount out of your budget with three teenage girls. So we don't look at it as just a woman's issue. It's a parent's issue, and it's a community issue. And I don't think it does as much, honestly, but I still think it can greatly impact anyone's life who's responsible for a family.
What are your plans for moving forward with the organization? You haven't been at this very long, just January. Are you planning more fundraisers, for example?
Yes. We would like to do one that's in the evening, and that's more what we were talking about, some family-friendly events, because there are a lot of women who wanted to be there yesterday, but they have young kids and they couldn't get away. And we'd like to do something quarterly. And
yeah. What kind of connection did you have with social service providers prior to this effort? Has this been an opportunity for you to learn more about the social service networks that exist in the Lansing area?
I personally have done what a lot of people have done and have dropped off donations at shelters. I've participated in can drives, but I would say this will give us a much deeper opportunity to understand the services they provide to their clients. But historically, I'm in the marketing field, and I've not had extensive interaction with social service agencies, no.
To what extent do you rely on volunteers here in the early going, Lizney?
Oh, a huge extent.
How many do you have?
I think we lost count yesterday, but we have a database started of folks who have stepped up to say, I'm willing to drive. What can I do? We have a Girl Scout troop in Okemos, Troop 161, that my daughter's a member of. They'll help distribute and sort the items and get them into bags. But I think just from people through Facebook and at the event, easily I could say 30 to 40 people have volunteered to distribute the products, help with thank you notes, all different capacities. So the response has been amazing.
And if people are hearing about this right now who would like to lend a hand, how do they connect with you?
They can connect. We have a Gmail address, which is helpingwomenperiod@gmail.com, or we're also on Facebook at Helping Women Period.
Are you aware of other efforts like yours anywhere? This is the first effort like this I've become aware of.
We did some brief research just online, and there is an organization in New York who we love their website and would hope to model ours after theirs when we get to that stage. There are pockets of them, but I do think it's a growing trend. In the New York Times article and in the Huffington Post, there's even a TED Talk on the subject. So I think it's out there, but I think it's in its infancy, and it's very small in scale at this point.
We want to thank you for joining us here today. We've been talking with two Lansing area neighbors in action, Amy Stevenson and Lizney Tate, the founders of the new Lansing nonprofit Helping Women, period, which provides feminine hygiene supplies to shelters for homeless and low-income women. Continued success. You're off to the races. We wish you the best.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Current State is looking for more nominations for our Neighbors in Action feature. Please help us out and email us your suggestions to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line or tweet us at KAR Current State and tell us a little bit about why you think they should be featured for the great work that they do. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Say the word hack or hacker and the impression you create is likely a negative one. Organizers of Sparta Hack are quick to point out their hacking event is about building and creating websites or apps or anything that's really connected to the digital world. It takes place beginning this Friday evening here at Michigan State University, Wells Hall. Sparta Hack is expected to attract about 300 participants. To learn more, we welcome Richard Enbody, a professor of computer science and a faculty advisor for Sparta Hack. Richard, welcome.
Thank you.
And Caitlin McDonald is a computer science student, organizer in the processor core of this here Sparta Hack event, from what I'm told. Welcome.
Happy to be here.
I'm a hunt and peck idiot, okay? I get alarmed just thinking about code and software. But you say that for let's say, students who are might be like me, unfortunately, largely uninformed about the digital world or the hacking world, you're open to those students as well.
Yeah, most definitely. So the really cool thing about hackathons, I think, is that it actually can bring together people from a lot of disciplines. So not just computer science students, not just coders, but you'll find that projects that have that work with designers that end up looking like a lot better or more usable at the end do better in like the competition aspect. So like, a lot of time designers come and join us. If you're a student who's focused more on building websites but maybe not as like a low level comp sci student, you also can build projects and do incredibly well. It's like it's a very open environment for a lot of different people.
But it actually sounds like a pretty good way to maybe jump in over your head and walk away an awful lot more informed about how computers work. I mean, would it be good for that, or should somebody be at a certain level of digital awareness before they dive into this?
So hackathons, another cool thing about them is that they're actually very useful for people of lots of different skill levels. So if you're a complete beginner, it's a really great place to go. There's a really great like mentorship environment. People are there. They're willing to help. They're willing to teach you. And so you can go and you can learn a brand new language, or you could go and you could learn a new platform. And you can also go if you're a complete expert and you want to build this idea you've had for a long time. So anywhere really on that spectrum is welcome.
Okay. Well, that's encouraging. You're a comp sci major yourself, Caitlin.
Yes.
What do you want to do after you graduate?
So I do a lot of work with interfaces with mobile and web, and that's my favorite thing to do. I kind of have a design specialization as well, so I'm kind of a tiny amateur designer. I'm not very good, but I really enjoy working with that kind of stuff, things that people use.
Richard, what's your role in this?
My role is mostly to keep out of her way. there's a very strong group and very active group of students that are putting this together. It's a tremendous amount of work. And I keep out of their way. They get a question or need a little nudge with something. But, you know, there's an unbelievable amount of energy and effort that goes into this.
You're forming teams, though. There's a team dynamic that's going to unfold. Talk to us about that.
Yeah. So do you want to talk about the organizing team or the teams that compete?
The teams that compete, let's say.
Perfect. So people can form teams of 1 to 4 people. So you can work on your own, but I find it's much more fun and rewarding to work on a team. And so you can show up with a team, or we have a team building sort of a time set aside on site during the first day. And basically, honestly, the team dynamic is really up to the people who are on the team, and basically you just have this like long period of time to work with these people and get as much as you can done on a project. And so some people, when you have a team of four, sometimes you can go like above and beyond, but I've seen teams of two do really, really well as well. So it's
Do the teams that get organized commit to a particular, do they try to establish a goal early in the process and say, this is what we're going to try to get done, or is it less formal than that?
Well, 100%. So at the very beginning, you'll pick a project and you'll say, okay, this is the thing we want to do. These are the technologies we want to use. This is our goal. This is what we want to make and demo at the very end. And then they'll work towards that. And then every once in a while, you'll find that they either like shot too high or they went too low and they like changed their mind, or lots of things can happen in 36 hours. So.
Yeah.
So one thing you might be useful to do, if you describe one that you've done.
Oh, okay.
This is not your first event either, from what I understand. I mean, you're a hackathon veteran,
and she and partners have done very well.
Do you have an idea for the project that you would like to be involved in this weekend?
Actually, so half of being an organizer involves I will not have time to be coding this weekend.
Okay, that was my next. I was wondering whether that was the case.
My project this weekend is Sparta Hack, so that is what I will be working on.
But what kinds of things do you think will be created? What kinds of things? What will come out of this? A certain number of websites, a certain number of apps. What?
Yeah. So it really the number of. Actual end projects really depends on the number of teams that are formed and how many people end up submitting something at the end. But I've seen some really cool projects in some of the hackathons I've been to. A couple weekends ago, we went to one. I travel with Erin Hoffman. She's another student. We typically go with a lot of other MSU students every once in a while. She and I just go on our own. But we saw a project last weekend that was this really cool. They had a mechanical engineer on their team, and they made this like workout mat that could tell what exercise you were doing, whether it was like push-ups or like side planks, and it would take that information and it would communicate it to an iOS app, and that iOS app would keep track of like the number of reps you'd done and like all this stuff. It was crazy.
How interesting. Caitlin McDonald is one of our guests. She's a computer science student here at Michigan State and one of the lead organizers for this weekend's Sparta Hack. She's joined by Professor Richard Enbody, a professor of computer science, who is doing his best just to stay out of the way of this whole event. But you're expecting hundreds of people. These people are coming from, I mean, the idea is to really attract people from hundreds of miles away.
Yeah, so we it's been a very long and interesting process. Our goal is 300 from the very beginning. And so, well, not the very beginning, but when we first like set this event in stone, we're like 300 students. We want to bring them from all over the Midwest if we can. So we actually just this last week finalized some buses, like the University of Waterloo to Oakland University and the University of Michigan. And we have students coming from universities in Minnesota. We have people coming from UIUC in Illinois.
Where is the University of Waterloo?
That is in Ontario.
Canada?
Yeah,
okay.
Canada.
Okay. So there's kind of a marathon vibe that unfolds here as well. People going without sleep. Without bathing,
yeah.
A lot of bad food, that kind of thing. Is that part of the landscape here?
That's sort of seems like a negative impression of it, because I've been to events where it is just like that. We have a big push for just trying to make sure everyone's like really comfortable. We have sleep rooms, so we have rooms that are dark and that have like 6 to 7 twin mattresses in there, so you can at any time you can take a break. There are people who go 36 hours. When we compete, we typically do not sleep, but we want to make sure that that's available for people who want to. Like, the bathrooms have things like Listerine and like spray deodorant, so you don't have to worry about like hygiene if you do stay for like 36 hours.
Okay.
So,
but the aim is to get students excited about technical innovation. Talk to me about the students that you have, Richard. How excited about innovation are they?
Well, I mean the field of computer science is really about solving problems, and this is a way for people to get together and hang out, learn from each other, and create something. I think a lot of people miss that about what computer science is. I mean, we're really about creating things, and it's being creative, it's solving problems, and this is getting a bunch of people together who understand that and want to learn more about it and practice it.
What are you anticipating, though, Richard? This is your first one of these events.
I'm sort of going into this blind in many respects, so probably one of the reasons why it's been best that I've kept out of the way. But yeah, you know, I mean, you know, I fully expect this to be sort of a high energy thing. I mean, if we could, you know, if we could plug wires into it, we could probably power the rest of the university out of Wells Hall this weekend.
I'm sure you could. Is it too late for people to get on board if they're just learning about this?
So we will be accepting MSU applicants through the end of the week. So basically up until the day of the event, you could even probably, I could probably say you could walk up and register on site. We have to get out of the way of the line because most people should be pre-registered at this point. But yeah, MSU students are we're accepting for a while.
It all happens at Wells Hall. It's Sparta Hack. It starts Friday afternoon, Friday evening.
Yes, so registration begins at 5 p.m. and actual competition begins around 8:30 p.m.
And it runs into Sunday,
yep, correct? 8:30 a.m.
And we want to thank Caitlin McDonald, computer science student and organizer of Sparta Hack, and Professor Richard Enbody of the MSU Department of Computer Science and a faculty advisor for Sparta Hack. Hope you have a lot of fun this weekend, and I hope it's really productive.
Thank you.
Have fun. That is our program for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, nearly 2 million Michiganders lack easy access to healthy foods like fruits and vegetables. Health advocacy groups are pushing the Michigan legislature to pitch in $10 million to help solve that problem. Plus, a seedy Oklahoma motel room is the backdrop for the MSU Theater Department's upcoming production, Bug. Current State's Melissa Benmark talks with the director, Rob Rosnowski. That and more tomorrow here on WKAR's Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Kevin Lavery was our director today. Thanks as well to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, April Van Buren, and to Drew Hill. Past episodes at WKAR.org. And don't forget, we're a podcast too. Check it out. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. Current State on WKAR.